Hi, this is Joy the Baker, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. You're the bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. This is Associate Producer Jess Seidman. We just had our big Jubilee conference last week, so Carrie is taking a little break. But don't worry, we'll still be talking to some of the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's secret to making rich, flavorful eggs is simple. The most possible space, the best possible feed, and lots of love. It's a healthy and humane recipe that makes your omelets, cakes, custards, and everything in between taste better. Want to get cracking? Visit hansenbrookfarm.com. Now for today's show. Because we at Cherry Bomb are all still in a Jubilee frame of mind, we're airing a conversation between Samin Nosrat and Nigella Lawson from Jubilee 2018. Samin was one of the keynote speakers at this year's Jubilee, and we thought it would be fun to see what was on her mind exactly 1 year ago and before the launch of her Netflix show. These women are so inspiring. I'm sure a lot of you own Nigella's cookbooks, as well as her issue of Cherry Bomb, and I'm sure a lot of you have watched Samin's show, so this conversation is a fascinating throwback. I didn't attend Jubilee last year, so this was my first time hearing this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. But first, a word from our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs.
Hansenbrook Farm believes that organic and pastured is the way to go when it comes to eggs. Pasture-raised means better lives for hens, better lives for small farmers, and better eggs for you. It's also better for chefs who depend on rich, flavorful eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's own flock of amazing chefs, their mother hens, count on it. Inat Admini is a mother hen. She's also the celebrated chef behind Taim, Balabusta, and Kish Kash in Manhattan. Want to learn how Chef Inat whips up her red shakshuka, an aromatic spicy tomato sauce into which she nestles eggs and lets them poach to perfection? You can find Chef Inat's Middle Eastern egg-centric recipes and videos on hansenbrookfarm.com. You can find their eggs at Publix, Kroger, Sprouts Farmers Market, Fresh Direct, and many natural food stores across the country.
Here's Samin Nosrat interviewing Nigella Lawson at last year's Jubilee.
She's nearly sitting on Samin's lap.
There. Oh, yeah. That would be, you're welcome. This is right. A dream. Hello.
Hello. So, this is the thing. I'm so excited to talk to Samin, and I love her book, and I love everything about her. So, the minute I saw her backstage, I avoided her.
I was like, I can't talk to you.
Because I just thought, otherwise, we'll say everything before. So then I had to say to her, you do know I'm actually looking forward to speaking to you, don't you? Because I realised that actually the fact that I was avoiding her might have looked a bit unfriendly.
No, I was like, please don't ask me any questions because I have to keep everything like a surprise for out there. Yeah.
Okay, so we both had the same idea.
It's just,
I feel quiet. Am I quiet?
Yeah. Are you? Okay.
That says something about me.
Oh, yeah.
That's bad.
Okay, so here's my plan. I did some homework, but I have a thesis statement that arose out of the homework, which is that I believe that you and I are secretly destined to be best friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm going to spend this talk proving it to you.
Yeah. Okay? Okay. I accept that.
Okay, great. So one of the things I think, Lonnie even mentioned it in her introduction, but it's really, I would say, one of your biggest points. It's right there on the first page of the introduction in this book, but every interview, everywhere, you're always saying, I'm not a chef, yeah. I'm a home cook. And I remember as a cook also really putting a lot of thought into the distinction of that terminology and choosing to refer to myself as a cook or a professional cook and not a chef. And earlier today, I don't know if you were here yet, but the two beautiful Ruths also referred to themselves as, Ruth Reichel had opened a restaurant for 15 years and she wasn't a chef and the other Ruth wasn't a chef. And so I wonder if there's a way that you have ever put a little bit of thought into what it is about we women who choose, you know, and for me it's a very distinct and intentional choice. To make this distinction and not go for chef.
Yes, and I think I'm going to, obviously there is a distinction. I think partly you could say it's about whether you cook primarily as a professional engagement. You know, or you can cook professionally, but you might see yourself as a cook. So maybe this is how I think of it. So I'm going to take that out of the equation now, because we all cook in different ways and they overlap or they're distinct, and that doesn't really matter. What I think is, the my notion of a chef comes from a slightly bullying, macho, male, conflict-driven, ego-driven theatre of war. And I think out of that conflict can come wonderful food. I understand that. And I think that I have friends who are male chefs who are not bullying and who are... not ego-driven. Everyone has to have, you know, ego plays a part in everything. You know, no one would get up in the morning without ego. So ego isn't, I'm not using ego as a swear word. But nevertheless, I think sometimes my notion of a chef is what creates the food is a certain desire for conflict and a certain adrenaline-fueled mania. And I think that what I seek in my cooking is to diffuse the fact that there's plenty of adrenaline-filled mania going on in my head. I cook to get rid of it. I don't channel it when I cook. I try to diffuse it. So I think for me, cooking is much more playful, and it's slightly about seeing, it's finding a relationship with the food. And I think that's very interesting for women, because we often are forced into not terribly healthy relationships with food. So I think it's finding a relationship with food, which means that you see what the food does when you cook, and yes, you are imposing a certain amount of order, but you're seeing how you take it, that you can somehow have, as it were, that, you know, how the food behaves and how you want it to be, to be slightly more in harmony. You're not trying to show the mastery over nature. I think, to some extent, I think cooking is a less confrontational pursuit than chefing.
Yes,
makes sense.
That makes total sense, and I think it's I have this line that I always say, and I read it, and you basically said the same thing. But I always say, if I had time or another lifetime, I would go back and do a dissertation on gender studies in the kitchen. Mm. And, you know, I'm so just infuriated about the fact that, you know, for 10,000 years ago, humans started cooking. And for 10,000 years, women cooked. And then 200 years ago, it became professionalized, and there was money and glory involved, and suddenly it was the man's space.
Yes.
And so could you just read, I printed out this amazing quote that you wrote in the Lenny letter this week, just here where it says Lenny letter.
Okay, so this, yes, I will. It's very logical stuff. Of course, there's a reason why the home cook has always been seen as a lesser creature. Traditionally, chefs have been male and paid. Home cooking was, I'm going to do it like The Simpsons, women's work, unwaged and taken for granted, sentimentally prized but not essentially valued or respected. There was a time when denigrating cooking and insisting on how hopeless you were at it were ways of establishing distance from the role of domestic drudge. And yet I have always felt that disparaging activity because it has been traditionally female is itself anti-feminist.
Yes, it's.
But I do think there are intrinsic difficulties in the sense that the restaurant cooking does demand these terrible hours, because in a way you are always working when everyone you know isn't working, and I think that there isn't really a way around that, and that's why I think that it's not my world, the restaurant world. But, I mean, I did work. I did wait at tables when I was at college. But what I do feel is that that's why community is very important. So something that, you know, that Cherry Bomb and the creating this community of women in professional kitchens, I think helps, because there may not be any, there may not be an answer to how do you get around those hours. There isn't. People are going to want to have dinner at night, and that means you're working at night.
Yeah. But
nevertheless, I think that it's perhaps now less isolating to be a woman in the business. I always feel quite odd, and I have to say, I do stress that I'm not a chef, and I think partly it's because I think there is a distinction, and also because I'm always, I think that I'm always slightly worried about being thought to be assuming too much for myself. Maybe this is actually quite a female
way of being.
I have that too. And I'm worried because, in a way, when you write food books, like, you know, you can do demos, and I feel like when I do demos, people must, you know, look and think, what is going on? I can do better than that, and I'm sure they can. I mean, you don't need skills to make, nice skills to make food taste good. And yet, I have to say, it can make me feel very nervous, because I think of as cooking as such a private activity, even though I do it for television, because I've had the same crew forever, and it's a very small crew. It still feels private to me. And so suddenly doing it in a public space, it can make me lose my sense of what it is. It feels like you're performing. And for me, cooking is not a performance.
Oh, I love that. So I think at the heart of this conversation, which has so many different sort of arms and tentacles, is something that I've been struggling with. I noticed I had a little Twitter spat with somebody the other day about the egg spoon. And yeah. I don't know if you're aware of the whole egg spoon thing. And it was a chef who focuses on molecular gastronomy who was really upset that I had compared the egg spoon, which is Alice Waters' famous egg spoon. You can read Kim Severson's amazing article about it. But it's this idea of like cooking over a fire, and that has drawn a lot of negative attention. And so I said, well, you know, there's this to be said for the egg spoon, but is it really any less accessible than cooking an egg sous vide at home? Because both implements cost $300, and which one do we do on a daily basis? Yet somehow the egg spoon is like given this precious identity, and the sous vide is something aspirational, because in general, that's like assigned to males, and that one's assigned, in this case, is identified with a female. And so this molecular chef had taken umbrage with my description of it and started provoking me. And finally, I realized, I kept standing up for myself because he kept calling me ignorant. And then finally, I was like, wait a minute, we're having a totally different argument. I'm talking about home cooking, and you're talking about the value of this thing in restaurants. And I think so much of the time, you know, cooking is this huge thing that involves all of us. We all eat, and we all feel ownership of having opinions, and it's valid for all of us to have opinions. Yet, that people love to make these sweeping generalizations about food or cooking, but restaurant cooking and home cooking are different. And also many different kinds of restaurants exist.
Indeed, and many, I know, the chefs I know well, and who cook for me in their homes, they cook differently. They understand the difference. But I also wanted to say something came into my mind when you mentioned the sous vide. I don't know if anyone else feels like this, but I feel I don't enjoy any, I've never cooked sous vide, I've never wanted to, but I don't enjoy any form of cooking that removes me from the food. Why do I want to put food in a bit of plastic and watch it cook?
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't understand. And I think that in the same ways, I prefer using my, stand mixer than a processor. I'll use a processor, but then this has got a casing on top and I can't interact with it. So in a funny way, I jealously guard my, as I say, my relationship with the food. I want to touch it, I want to smell it, I want to feel it. And that's all really important to me. So that's what came to mind, the sous vide. And I'm sure it's great. And I'm sure I think fantastic. And let other people do it. And I find that sometimes the texture is a bit spooky.
Yeah.
But I mean, nevertheless, I can see that I can see that it works. And if you want to, and I think maybe, just we're all different in life, and some people want to control what happens in cooking more. And I do want to control it, but only up to a point. I quite like that factor, random factor, that really things change a bit. You know, your oven burns hotter one day than another. You know, that if the weather's different, that your skillet's going to be colder or warmer when you start off, and all those things, which I know these variables, which I feel make it quite hard when explaining how long you cook something for, nevertheless, to me, make sort of keep it alive a bit.
Well, absolutely, and I think that's one thing I feel like I share with you very much is being drawn to the senses. And you're always using very sensual words. And I'm always like, you got to put your hands in it and feel it and smell it and touch it and taste it. And the adjectives, to me, if I can get anything across on the page, it's how should you feel?
Yes.
What should be going? And I think that that's something I've never thought about that, but that physical divorcing from the food is probably also a reason why.
And I like an oven.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm not that, I do like an oven. I can open it. I can see it. It's not that I don't like that. But it doesn't feel, it doesn't feel remote in the same way.
Absolutely.
As something, the idea of sous vide or.
Absolutely. So speaking of foods, so I, can you sum up, so what appears to me is like you've collected really your winning home recipes. You're winning like, but when I flip through this, I'm like, my friend and I were looking at it and he's like, wow, she's really just good at putting together all the dishes that you just want to eat when you're drunk. And so it's really funny because I actually put on Twitter a couple weeks ago, I said, does anyone have any questions for Nigella? And they said, what would she make for herself when she's drunk? And I was like, I think she makes a lot of this stuff. And so, but it is, I think one of my favorite things about you and some of my friends too is that you have this like, it's these private moments, and cooking and eating is really, also, as much as it is about sharing around the table and taking care of people, it's also that like emergency brownie at night, or the thing you eat when you're like sent everyone away after the dinner party and you're like cleaning up and you're eating your own chicken because you didn't have it at the dinner table. So how, what is the role of private and public, private
eating? I think, and this is something that was really important to me when I started, I think it's, women often feel they don't have permission to eat. They have permission to feed people. They're encouraged to feed other people, but they're not encouraged to, we're not encouraged to feed ourselves. And it's, when I grew up, people would say things like, I shouldn't really be eating this. But, and I think that is a terrible thing. I mean, my mother didn't eat. She cooked, but she didn't really eat. And I think it's very important to learn the pleasure of eating. And I think it's actually the only way to have any sort of relationship with food, because as we all know, what you stop yourself from eating, you eat more of. When I started writing about food, because I was a journalist before who didn't write about food, a lot of my girlfriends kept saying, but is it going to be safe? And I said, I'm not working with nuclear waste here. But they really did think that I would be, then I would just eat so much and it would be so difficult. And I just think, and I just thought, yes, but that's you're thinking all the time about, what you mustn't eat. Therefore, it's making you crazy. And then you eat things, you don't even get pleasure. My second book had a subtitle, Eating, Baking and the Art of Comfort Cooking, because what's called comfort eating is often discomfort eating, but comfort cooking is wonderful because it shores you up. You're feeding yourself. The act of saying, I am worth taking care of and sustaining and keeping alive is incredibly important. And I think that cooking is an act of generosity and kindness, and it's important to be generous and kind to oneself as well as to other people. And so I feel that's very important, and I like eating. I actually, and sometimes I just feel that, just like I love reading a book, I like to sit quietly and read a book, I like to sit quietly and eat. I always feel awful that I eat so fast, that it's over so quickly. And sometimes I just think, that's it. I wish I could just turn back the clock and just start at the beginning of the meal again, because it was so good. But I feel that I suppose I I never think, oh, it's just me, therefore I won't bother. And it doesn't mean to say I always cook, because taking pleasure in food means taking pleasure in all food. I think that just as we're encouraged to use food as a way of persecuting ourselves, we're often encouraged to use that sort of thing of cooking as I'm such a great person. You know, as I always say to people, it doesn't make you a great person. It's not a moral force for good. It's enormously enjoyable if you enjoy it. And often it's enjoyable if you think you don't, because you just have to get there. But I don't think it makes anyone better than anyone else. It's just pleasure. I mean, it's just pleasure. And, you know, life is such that I don't think any of us can afford to turn away from pleasure when it offers itself.
I would agree with that, especially in this moment.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, you are the patron saint of pleasure. And it really is just, it's this incredible through line through everything is enjoying the food. And I think there's a way where that can get twisted sometimes, you know, people's perception of it or projection of that onto the way that you are viewed or even the idea of like what kind of food that it is that you're bringing, you know. But flipping through the book, there's so much what could be in any like healthy eating book. So it's not that you're just
No, I know people think certain that. Things, but I love all food.
Yeah.
You know, I don't eat a bowl of kale to be good. I do because I love. I mean, I love vegetables. Funny enough, I once had to see someone because I wasn't feeling very well, and she said to me, a nutritionist or doctor. She said, you're the first person I've ever told to eat fewer vegetables.
That's amazing.
I know. But you know, I think, you know, my first husband died of oral cancer, and he was ill as I was writing my first book, and I so saw what it was like when food is taken away from someone and they can't eat, and how important it is for our connections with one another to realize how lucky it is to be able to eat. And, you know, also those of us in this room and in this, you know, all of us who can afford to eat, who have the blessing of food in our life, I think to take it lightly is a bad thing.
Yeah.
One of the questions I'm always asked is, like, what is your guilty pleasure? Like, what's
guilty
guilt
about
to
it?
Pleasure? You know, what I always say to people is that I think the only thing you should feel guilty about is not taking pleasure. You know, there are a lot of people who haven't got food, who haven't got all the things that we have to make our life feel materially and better, that we're looked after, we can look after our kids or ourselves. And I think for that reason, to, you know, not to take pleasure in it, or it seems such a distortion of any sensible value system.
I would agree with that. That's amazing. I wonder about, you know, I was looking through this, and there's such an amazing combination of foods. And I just bookmarked a few because my friend pointed out, he said, the funny thing about this is so many of these recipes could be in someone else's cookbook. You know, there's things that seem like they have the Ottolenghi touch, or they have the, I don't know, Samin touch, or all these things. But what's distinct about this is that the combination of them could only be yours. And so, and I love that. And there's a really beautiful, as part of your, I think, love of pleasure, it's one of the things that could absolutely be something that I eat. I don't know if I would have the courage to put it in a cookbook, is this egg tortilla pie.
Yes, I know. Well, that's the thing. It's
very Samin, like, midnight snack thing, where it's a flour tortilla with a cracked egg and ham and cheese. And my friend looked at it, he's like, oh, you'd totally make that and put another tortilla and hot sauce on top. And then it has another tortilla and hot sauce on top. It's just, like, the simplest things.
Yeah,
you know.
I also think that, in a way, cooking... those of us who write recipes also know, and as anyone who cooks, that cooking isn't just about recipes, it's about ideas. So sometimes when someone, you know, I'm often told off for, having recipes that are too simple. And I feel like, well, it's an idea. You can read it as a recipe. I'm not saying it's like sometimes I say, yeah, it's hard to give a weight enough to, you know, enough breed to spread on a bit of bread, or, you know. And also, as someone on Twitter once said to me, it's like, yes, sure, like anyone ever makes themselves something to eat and then says, that was really delicious, a pity it was so simple to make. No. But actually, sometimes it just looks like you're making a great claim that something's a recipe. Like that, making that egg tortilla pie, it's not really a recipe, but because it's in book of recipes, it seems to, you know, I don't take it, it doesn't, it's not there to be taken seriously, it's just there to be eaten.
Well, yeah, John. Thank you. The other thing I love is there's quite a lot of desserts in this book.
Yeah.
And your, you know, to me, one of the things that is distinct about you as a person in the cook world, in the cooking world, is that I think of you equally as a sweet and a savory cook. Like often, you know, there are people who I look to for their baking recipes or their savory recipes. And I feel like that's a particularly British thing. Really, there is a way that the British really have a relationship to dessert that is different than we have here, I think, to sugar, maybe as a whole. And next, on Tuesday, actually, I'm going to London, and one of my very favorite things to do is to go to Waitrose and walk up and down the baking aisle, because there's just, like, if you guys ever go to England, you just have to go to the grocery store, because they have, in the baking aisle, there's, like, petit-four packets and chopped candy for your fruit bread, and just there's pavlovas. I mean, people know what a pavlova is, and there's a way where there seems to be sort of a space of honor given at the table for dessert.
I think it's very there are a few things I'd say about that, which is that our notion of dessert is very distinct from any French notion of patisserie. So it's very basic, often. But also, so I never baked or did anything like that. And then when I wrote my first book, I thought, well, I will try some baking. I'd always thought there were cooks and there were bakers, very, very different. And then I thought, wait a minute, this is actually very easy. Bakers have this smug air, like it's quite complicated. Like, okay, and you need this thing, the pastry hands, you need to be able to do this, you need to do that, and actually, you don't. Yes, you have to follow certain rules, but then after a while, you're still thinking about flavor. And so that's why my second book, with Eve, I have to say, ironically titled How to Be a Domestic Goddess.
Yes.
No one ever understands that, but still. And I wrote about it because I came to baking so late. And so I always feel if I can do it, other people can, because I thought I wasn't that kind of a person. And I think in life, it's so wonderful to realize sometimes that actually, you can be that kind of a person. Mm-hmm. And that makes a huge difference. Now, the strange thing is, I don't have a particularly sweet tooth, but I absolutely adore baking. I mean, if you said to me, what would you rather have, sweet or savory? I would go for savory.
Wow.
I mean, I would not.
I never would have guessed.
But I would never rule out sweet things, but I like making them. And I try make, a lot of my sweet things aren't quite as sweet as, say, you might get in an American recipe. Mm-hmm.
How do you think, you know, how do you view the two cultures' relationship to dessert differently?
I feel that if I'm adapting an American recipe, I know, if I'm cooking one, I know I will need to reduce the sugar an awful lot. But on the other hand, I think that I think there's a fantastic baking tradition. See, I found, you think the English bake, but I was inspired by the American tradition because I think there's a wonderful baking tradition in America. And it's perhaps more rural.
Mm-hmm.
And so that inspired me. And I often I think of my baking book as very much an American-inspired book. So I think perhaps in countries, I think there's more, the rural versus urban people have more in common with than whether necessarily from geographical differences.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I was going to say about baking as well, which is that I think that there's a magic about baking that plays into our desire for transformation, because it is much more alchemical.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing.
I think those sum of the parts, you know, greater than the sum of the parts recipes are often the baking recipes.
Yes,
where
I think
it's like
they
flour
are.
And butter and sugar. How did it become this?
And I think also, no one needs a cake, but that's what makes it something special and wonderful and a treat. And I think also, we all, you know, we need to get food on the table. And I love cooking. I also, it can also be a chore sometimes. And in fact, when I start, I sometimes think, I just want to lie down. Okay, I will get up and cook. And I do, and I get up and cook, and then I feel a bit better. But baking is always, something both exciting and calming to do. And you don't need to, but you want to. In the same way as you don't need to eat a cake, but you want to. And I think in that sense, it's so hugely enjoyable to do. And I love the feeling. I do enjoy baking, I have to say.
You are so thoughtful. The way you speak, the way you put words together is so beautiful. And just listening, I could listen to you for so long. And I remember I felt that way from the very first time I read any of your works. And in How to Eat, you have an essay, your first book, from 1998, from 20 years ago. You have an essay about mayonnaise that is so beautiful and literary. And there's just a way, even in there's the head note of for mayonnaise in this book, you made up amazing words saying, like, you love it so much it makes you feel condimental, you know? you play with words so beautifully. I mean, you had a whole career as a writer before you entered into the food world. And I feel like you really have this self-conception as, you know, a hedonist in the best way, right? And yet, like, there's this thing that really sort of bugs me, because as I've been preparing and talking about you, and I was talking to one of my editors at the Times the other day, and she said, you know, the thing that makes me, you know, I wish I could ask her is, why, when I was searching about you on the internet, so many of the descriptions are about the way you look. And people often think of your beauty and your body first. And to me, which is not a bad thing, it's amazing, but also you are this there's so much more to you, and the self-conception and the message. If I didn't know what you looked like and I picked up your book, I would be like, this woman, her food is so beautiful. The recipes work. The literature is so great. And I just wonder, like, you know, I was just watching an interview with you in Australia where the guy brought up, you know, he was trying to push you into a corner about being sexy and stuff. And I just wonder, like, what do you feel about, you know, the thing that's projected onto you who you are?
Well, I feel that always makes me feel really worried that I'm going to be a disappointment. That's what I think. But anyway, I think is that television plays into that. You can't be on television where, in a way, you know, that things are slightly, there's an idealized version of a person presented and then complain. And I think I think that's difficult, but
it's freaking me out right now.
But I do feel, and once you're on television too, people project all sorts of things onto you and you just have to sort of slightly disconnect from it, I think. But I do feel I have a real relationship with my readers and they understand me. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's fine. I mean, I have to say, you know, I'm always, you know, being photographed around London, you know, with very, very, you know, I haven't brushed my hair and I'm not wearing makeup, and believe me, it's not a, you know, it's not a great sight. And I think the thing is that for me, although then I just do feel a bit stressed, you know, that it's very important not to play into that. Now, of course, I'm sitting here and I've had my makeup done and I've had my hair done and I'm very happy about that, and thank you, Trish. But I also feel that I need a certain amount of armor to come on a stage. Mm-hmm. I would feel slightly, and I need that. And I think that perhaps for me that becomes a thing that makes me, because I'm actually quite, I wouldn't say reserved, it's not the right word, but I was always a very shy person, and I'm not really now, but I can be. And I think I can feel, we all can feel quite vulnerable, you know, but, and so I think I need, that is something I need, but then I know that by putting on that, by having this, all these things that slightly perfect one and make one look better than, you know, not really real, you're playing into it. So I am, as you can say, I don't have any answers there.
Yeah. Okay. No, well, you're also freaking me out because I have been working on a show that's going to be released this year. And I spend a lot of time, I mean, maybe not too much time, but definitely some time worrying about what it is that is going to be projected onto me. And so, I was watching a food show that was recently released with a male host who rolled out of bed at 4 a.m. and rolled out of bed and went straight in the cab, and they immediately started filming. And I was like, interesting, you know, because I couldn't, and I don't even, like, I spent my life in kitchens. Like, I'm not super versed in the makeups and the clothes and stuff.
But are you going in for that? Are you doing makeup?
I did, I had to do it myself and stuff a little bit, but it's
You know, but in a way, you do need certain things, and I think it is quite difficult. I think as much as possible, you have to resist other people's accounts of you or being pushed in a certain way, but it is difficult because we're all humans and we have ordinary human vanity and we want to be made to look as good as we can to hide certain. You don't necessarily want to. No one leaves the house. Well, I do sometimes, I'm not on purpose. But no one absolutely wants to say, here, dwell on the things I'm, more uncomfortable with. I mean, I've always, for me, it's the thing has always been on my weight, whether I'm thinner or fatter or this or that. And I always try and, ignore that. But as a woman, as a woman going on a TV program as not a thin woman, you get an enormous amount of aggressive behaviour.
Yeah.
And as if somehow, you're slightly offended. All these perfect Adonises, these men who are really upset you're not looking quite right, or else they're claiming that it's fine. So I sort of feel you, in a way, I'm very glad I didn't do TV when I was young, because I think that would have been very, very disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. Any other advice for me? Please help me. I'm looking at it.
I think it's much easier to be filmed, don't you, than to have your photograph taken. Because when you're filming, you're thinking and talking. So therefore, you're not aware of yourself. But when you're having a photograph taken, you're an object much more. And I think that's harder. And I think there's much, I don't know, I don't have any answers because I have a lot of questions myself about the whole thing about being on TV and how you're presented. But in a way, I don't know, how should a woman be? I mean, we can be all sorts of different things, and we are. And so I think that's what television has to encompass.
Yes, I mean, that's why there just has to be more, right? More of us on there. And so, to me, I wonder if, what is, has this sort of movement and this like feminism really landed in your sphere in London? And like, is this something that you are seeing changes being made? And are there more shows coming on with women? And
well, we do have quite a few shows. There are certain things I'm not really, I don't really belong in any world, because that's the thing. I work at home. I don't know. I mean, it's always been important for me, and I certainly feel that I have never let anyone. I don't let people tell me what to do. I mean, I have a thing of being slightly anxious to please, but I'm certainly, I am my own boss, and I originate the material. I am not scripted. I originate material. I do a program when I want to, and I don't when I don't, and I'm in this lucky position, which a lot of women aren't in, but then a lot of men aren't in either. And but I'm very interested in seeing a younger generation, of women, and I know plenty of women in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud of how. Embattled is the wrong word. They're not so much embattled, but they're going forth proudly, and they seem not to take any nonsense. My generation, took a lot of rubbish, and it's okay. We're here, and we've come out the other side. But I like it that they won't.
I love that. I love that. Are there any, this is my last question, is like, which sort of cooks from this generation and writers, contemporary writers, are the people who are inspiring you? I mean, I know there's probably the Elizabeth Davids and the M.F.K. Fishers.
Oh, yeah, there's
who's
lots.
Now who's just like filling you up with joy?
Oh, well, you are.
Oh, thanks.
You know that. On my website, I have a little thing called Cookbook Corner because I think it's really important that we share one's enthusiasms, and I like that. So I like Olya Hercules, Yasmin Khan is here.
Yes.
She's great. And I feel that, you know, there are lots of writers I don't know about yet. Diana Henry, I like. Yeah. And I feel there are a lot of writers I don't know about, and I'm always interested. And that's also why it's interesting for me to come to the States and see what's going on. And, you know, I think that what I feel about cooking is that, you know, it is about, you know, it is really a thing about sharing. And the thing about food is it's such a fantastic conversation. So there's always a fresh conversation to be had. And
there really is.
You know.
It's amazing. It's at the same time that there's sort of, I always say there's nothing new in cooking, right? Everything's been done before, but also there's always something new.
Yes, yeah. And actually it isn't newness that one seeks. It's connection. Isn't that the whole point about being alive? It's connection. Yeah. And that's what I get when I read. And the interesting thing about food is that you can feel a tremendous sense of connection with someone whose food is so very different, because it's how you approach it, it's perceived. And I'm sorry, I do carry on talking for too long.
No, you could just talk forever. We would just sit here. So, I mean, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're amazing. Thank you.
That's it for today's show. I wanted to say a special thank you to everyone who came, volunteered, and spoke at Jubilee this year. I could not have asked for a better first Jubilee. It was amazing to meet and enjoy such a wonderful day with the Bomb Squad. And if you couldn't make it, don't worry, we'll be airing all the talks and conversations from Jubilee 2019 later this year on Radio Cherry Bomb. Thank you to our sponsor, Hanson Brook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs, for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb. For more, visit hansenbrookfarm.com. Radio Cherry Bomb's regular host is the one and only Carrie Diamond, who will be back next week, I promise. And our theme song is by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, my name's Carrie Diamond. I am the co-founder of Cherry Bomb, rescue cat mom, and coffee shop owner. You know who I think is the bomb? All the Jubilee volunteers. I just wanted to say thank you for all your time and your energy. We couldn't do Jubilee without you.